This is the Crime Story Podcast with Carrie Antholis, where stories of crime and justice are told. On today's podcast, we continue the crime story serialization of Catherine Mader's Inside the Robe, a judge's candid tale of criminal justice in America, which best-selling author Michael Connelly called a perfect book and grossing and telling at the same time. In Part 89, Judge Mader discusses the complex considerations when resolving conflicts between parties in court. The judge then looks at the Thanksgiving holiday and reflects on what she is thankful for in the American criminal justice system. You can find this excerpt in written form at crimestory.com.
November 21st. The conclusion to the case of the fake animal control officers described on August 26 unfolded in court this morning. Both of the women had entered a stranger's home to, quote-unquote, rescue a dog in distress. As the women were dressed in fake uniforms, one with a mail order badge, the victim surrendered his dog to them. The women promptly took the dog to a vet, then righteously claimed they were performing a heroic act instead of the crime of burglary. The DA's office treated the women with unusual compassion, allowing them to plead guilty to a felony, but agreeing to reduce it to a misdemeanor at the time of sentencing if 220 hours of community service were performed. The defendants had no difficulty completing the community service, especially because it was done at an animal shelter. When one of the defendants appeared for sentencing in my court, she had a new attorney and she wanted to withdraw her plea. Her attorney claimed, "When my client pled guilty, she didn't realize that her conviction would prevent her from getting a license for her new business, selling pet insurance." The criminal supervisor, whom I've described as being harsh on criminal defense attorneys and defendants, must have had a soft spot for dog rescuers. He agreed to let her change her plea to the misdemeanor of misusing a badge, which strangely would not cause licensing problems. On February 4th, I wrote of a judge who was involuntarily transferred because he wouldn't work with a difficult public defender. Since that day, I've spoken with a colleague with a different take on the situation. My colleague suggested, "It's unfortunate the aggrieved judge had to be transferred from a location and assignment he preferred, but we should look at the bigger picture. It gives a lot of power to a defense attorney if he or she thinks that they can force a judge from their courtroom by being difficult. If an attorney sees this method can succeed to his client's advantage, it will happen more often." There is a natural tension between a supervising judge running a courthouse and another judge inhabiting a trial courtroom. A judge responsible for running a courthouse might feel a strong obligation to push back against attorneys, either prosecution or defense, who are trying to exercise control by bullying a judge. While that might disturb the affected judge, no reaction at all might be best for the smooth functioning of the courthouse. Years back, in an infamous incident, a public defender was slugged by his client in court because he wanted a different public defender. The judge was inclined to give the client a new lawyer, believing at first that there was an obvious conflict between the client and his attorney. However, the public defender's office argued strenuously against allowing the defendant to get a new attorney. Their position was, "If you allow this defendant to get a new attorney because he slugs the one in court, every public defender is going to get slugged by their client." The judge did not change the attorney, and the policy remains in effect. There have been a few slugging issues, as well as even stabbing of public defenders by defendants with smuggled razor blades and sharpened pencils. These actions never result in the substitution of attorneys. The policy seems wise when you think of the thousands of cases each year represented by the public defenders and the minute number of attacks. November 22nd. The week before the Thanksgiving holiday is notoriously slow. I even forgot to look at my calendar before I started work today and missed greeting the jurors in a jury assembly room, a task meted out to each judge several times a year. Each judge greets jurors differently. The jurors arrive bleary-eyed and resentful after receiving a robocall to be at the courthouse at 8 o'clock in the morning sharp. The attendance process allows time for stragglers. If a juror is the punctual type and arrives at 8 a.m., they will spend 2 hours waiting in a large, sterile assembly room. A quote-unquote reward for prospective jurors is being greeted by a real judge. I deliver a set speech, but add a few new remarks each time. Judges have gotten into disciplinary trouble by trying to be too funny or real during jury greetings. One new judge, doing the greeting for the first time, told jurors, "In my experience, most defendants are guilty of something, and it's the juror's job to find out what that something is." This was duly reported by a juror who was sent to a trial court where an earnest judge tried to explain the concept of the presumption of innocence. "But, Your Honor," the juror said, "we were just at the jury orientation, and the judge there said that everyone arrested is guilty of something." The entire jury panel that had been oriented by the new judge had to be re-educated and then discharged. It's heartwarming how many people, particularly immigrants, are proud to sit on a jury and play a part in a system that's different from what they've experienced in their home country. This stands in contrast with others who avidly search the internet for excuses to avoid jury duty, most of which judges have heard multiple times. I've gone to parties where people, after finding out I'm a judge, brag that, "I just couldn't reschedule my patients for a week-long jury trial. I was able to convince my last judge that because of its importance, I couldn't be gone that long. Someday I'd like to serve, of course." They are taken aback when I say, "I'm the last person you should be telling about how successful you were to avoid service. You'd be the first to take advantage of the jury system if your kids or you were in trouble. I would never have released you." November 23rd. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, then a week's vacation. I'm thankful for so much. I'm grateful to live in a country with a criminal justice system which, while flawed and sometimes arbitrary, is capable of compassion and fairness. I hope the continuing movement to reform excessive sentencing laws will continue. I'm thankful that, at least in California, most judges strain to remain impartial, educated, and follow the law. We have not had the same corruption scandals as other states. No briberies, no judges operating private jails, conspiring to send juveniles there for personal profit, no lenient sentences for friends and relatives. We even have a relatively uncorrupted system for becoming judicial officers. Not only can our elected governor appoint qualified judges, but there is a screening process involved that, in theory at least, finds the best qualified candidates. Even those not in political favor can go to the voters and try to become a judge through election. Judges in other states are often selected by political parties or by contributing large sums to politicians. But it is far from the norm. I'm thankful that I had the opportunity to become an elected judge and to securely hold this office for 16 years. Watching the continued politicization of the judiciary in other states, I'm grateful that my job is secure, with generous benefits and enough money to live comfortably. In other states, hundreds of thousands of dollars are poured into judicial races, often by PACs trying to force out judges considered insufficiently partisan. This has led to the expulsion of fine and honest judges. Having observed criminal juries in action and seeing how seriously they take their task, I feel thankful to all who have participated. From a minor DUI to a major murder trial, something magical happens when 12 people deliberate the fate of a fellow member of the community. I see and admire people's basic goodness. Regardless of whether they thought they would be done on a Friday afternoon, jurors often go beyond personal convenience to make sure they've made the correct decision. I'm thankful others have recognized that I do good work and have assigned me to a court where I make decisions that impact people's lives. Whether it's having traveled the world, learned from experiences of others here and abroad, raised 3 children, or having had 4 decades of a career I've loved, it's all come together. I feel comfortable that the dozens of decisions I make daily are solid. I'm grateful to toil among colleagues with whom I get along and with whom I can easily communicate. Having felt like an outsider in other environments, I am thankful to have found surroundings where I fit. I greet people when I arrive and say goodbye at the end of the day without twinges of discomfort, harboring no sense that others wish me anything but goodwill. And the same for my staff. We are all happy and work well collaboratively. Studies verify that as people age, they become happier with their lives. I agree. I know my strengths, I know my weaknesses, and I accept them. I'm grateful that I've enjoyed good health and vitality, while some of my friends and family have had their lives tragically cut short. I have no regrets. My wish for next year is for healing the political divisions in our country and continued health and good cheer for my family, friends, and colleagues. Thanksgiving for me is more meaningful than Christmas or Hanukkah, even though I don't descend from pilgrims. The quote-unquote holidays have no significance for me. My secular Jewish parents always had a Christmas tree, their attempt to fit in. That was important to them, but I will never understand how they could have so easily discarded their Jewish heritage. I could never pretend to be Christian. I'm grateful I have received the heritage and culture of Judaism. The religious part doesn't grab me. I hope that next year, growing anti-Semitism in my country will fade away.
That concludes part 89 of Inside the Robe by Catherine Mader. The audio was edited by Jody O'Keefe. For more storytelling news and narrative analysis in the world of crime and justice, head over to crimestory.com. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next Crime Story podcast.